Chapter 2. Every Boy His Own Teacher. If not to some peculiar end designed, studies the specious trifling of the mind, or is at best a secondary aim, a chase for sport alone and not for game. Edward Young. Love of Fame. Cubbyholes are magical spaces. Store something in a cubbyhole, and it just might transform itself into something else. Well, that object doesn't really change, but the times change, and so does the person who stored it there, either of which amounts to the same thing. Above the topmost bookshelves in his permanent library at Mount Vernon, George Washington had dozens of built-in cubbyholes, or pigeonholes, as they were called in his day. That is, before that word became a verb and took on pejorative connotations. In those dark compartments he stored many personal papers, some dating back to his adolescence. The manuscripts that Washington saved since his school days in the 1740s became something very different by the end of his life. They transformed themselves into a blueprint of his mind. This set of miscellaneous manuscripts contains essential documents for reconstructing George Washington's school days. Beyond the exercises that form the lion's share of these early manuscripts, details of Washington's education are sparse. In an unfinished biography, his aide-de-camp, personal secretary, friend, and confidant David Humphreys says that a domestic tutor took charge of Washington's education. Humphrey's precise language offers a good idea of the kind of teacher Washington had as a boy. Typically, affluent families alone could afford domestic tutors for their children. As the job title suggests, the domestic tutor was a live-in teacher who accepted room and board along with a modest salary. Washington's tutor taught grammar, logic, rhetoric, geometry and higher mathematics, geography, history, and additional studies which are not improperly termed the humanities. The name of Washington's domestic tutor has escaped history. Considering the eclectic nature of the surviving school exercises, his editors suggest that Washington had several teachers. Further evidence shows that at one point in his education, Washington did attend school with other boys. Friend and fellow patriot George Mason mentioned to him a man named David Piper, whom he described as my neighbor and your old schoolfellow. Like Washington, Piper would turn to surveying once he left school, becoming surveyor of roads for Fairfax County. He was also something of a bad boy. Piper was repeatedly brought to court on various civil and criminal matters. Together, Washington and Piper could have attended school at the Lower Church of Washington Parish, Westmoreland County, where Maddox Creek enters the Potomac River, but there is no saying for sure. The story of Washington's education is shrouded in mystery. His school exercises indicate what he studied inside the classroom and out. They show him mastering many different subjects, learning what he would need to make his way through colonial Virginia, whether that way took him down a deer track or up Duke of Gloucester Street. Some of the exercises are dated, revealing that this set of school papers as a whole ranges from 1743 to 1748, that is, from the year Washington turned 11 to the year he turned 16. Other evidence demonstrates that he continued his studies beyond the latest exercises in the manuscript collection. Altogether, the exercises in the books Washington read during his school days reveal his early literary interests, his fascination with mathematics, and the genesis of his career as a surveyor. Washington became curious about poetry in his youth, as two manuscript poems that survive with the school exercises reveal. When he first read these poems, he transcribed them to create personal copies he could reread whenever he wished. His copies reveal Washington's ambition to excel in penmanship, and their texts shed light on his state of mind at the end of adolescence. One is titled On Christmas Day. Given its subject, the poem's imagery is predictable. It is filled with happy shepherds and hymn-singing angels watching over the newborn Savior. The speaker of the poem is female. She ends by reminding herself to remember Christmas always. The bottom corner of the page containing Washington's transcription is torn, so the last two lines of verse are damaged. His source supplies the missing words. Oh, never let my soul this day forget, but pay in grateful praise her annual debt to him whom 'tis my trust I shall adore when time and sin and death shall be no more. The picture of young Washington that emerges from his copy of this poem is that of a boy confident in his religious beliefs, but pleased to have another confirm them. This Christmas poem is akin to a Christmas present, something to treasure for itself and for what it symbolizes. Washington recorded neither his source nor the poet's name, but On Christmas Day comes from the February 1743 issue of the Gentleman's Magazine. The published poem is signed Orinthia, the pseudonym for Elizabeth Taft, a Lincolnshire poet. The transcription also reveals Washington's fastidiousness. In the Gentleman's Magazine, editor and publisher Edward Cave capitalized each line of the poem but avoided capitalizing other nouns. Copying the poem for himself, Washington capitalized the nouns Cave had left uncapitalized, giving the written text a more traditional look. True Happiness, the other poem that survives among the manuscripts from Washington's school days, also appeared in the Gentleman's Magazine, though in a much earlier issue, that of February 1734. Taken together, the two poems create a vivid picture of Washington's boyhood reading process. After enjoying On Christmas Day in a recent issue of the Gentleman's Magazine, he wished to read more verse and searched whatever back issues were available. The magazines listed in his father's estate inventory cannot be identified precisely, but they were most likely bound volumes of the Gentleman's Magazine, one of the few English periodicals available at the time. Each issue of the Gentleman's Magazine contains a poetry column. After he encountered On Christmas Day, it seems, Washington read a number of back issues until he found another poem he liked, which he transcribed onto the opposite side of the leaf containing On Christmas Day. Washington was one of many colonial American readers who enjoyed the Gentleman's Magazine. When Edward Cave began editing and publishing this periodical in January 1731, he gave birth to a new form of publication, which in turn gave rise to new forms of writing. The start of the Gentleman's Magazine marks the start of the modern magazine. It was so successful that sometimes Cave had to reprint back issues to meet demand. Unlike modern magazines, it was not something to read one month and throw away the next, but something to treasure, to keep for future reference. Thomas Jefferson shelved bound volumes of this and other magazines with his encyclopedias, seeing them as similar kinds of work. Like sets of encyclopedias, multi-volume collections of magazines could serve as repositories of miscellaneous information. A long-running magazine amounted to a modern encyclopedia. Other Virginians treasured their back issues of Gentleman's Magazine. Washington's adolescent use of the Gentleman's Magazine is consistent with the way his fellow Virginians used it. The Gentleman's Magazine appealed to readers throughout colonial America. Using the editorial pseudonym Sylvanus Urban, Edward Cave started the magazine as a digest of London newspapers for country readers, but quickly expanded its scope, seeking original contributions and cultivating a circle of reader correspondents willing to submit their work, especially their poetry, for publication. The poetry section that closes each issue provided a forum for Elizabeth Teft and other aspiring poets through the English-speaking world. Different types of literature, political writings, reports of military campaigns, scientific essays, filled the pages of Gentleman's Magazine during Washington's youth. The February 1743 issue is fairly typical. Besides On Christmas Day and several other poems, it contains recent parliamentary proceedings, a list of English nobility, an essay about an ongoing economic controversy, an article discussing the wool industry, observations on a passing comet, a slave narrative, political essays, extracts from recent pamphlets, a record of current events, and a list of recent literature. Publishing maps to accompany the military reports, an innovative technique, Gentleman's Magazine let readers imagine the campaigns that the articles described. Perhaps these pages gave Washington his first inkling of military strategy. The miscellaneous essays helped popularize other fields of study, bringing the sciences to general readers in both Great Britain and America. In his library at Mount Vernon, Washington had at least three volumes and several odd numbers of the Gentleman's Magazine, the first of many magazines he would collect. True happiness, to get back to the poem, offers a recipe for an ideal life that many local readers found appealing. In the coming years, numerous poems in the Virginia Gazette would echo its sentiments. True happiness stresses the value of a prosperous rural existence, a good estate on healthy soil, where friends and family would gather round a warm fire and enjoy a pleasant joke. The poet's list of necessities for happiness continues as it emphasizes marital bliss, physical fitness, mental equanimity, friendship, conviviality, simple fare, and drink in moderation. In other words, a quiet wife, a quiet soul, a mind as well as body whole, prudent simplicity, constant friends, a diet which no art commends, a merry night without much drinking, a happy thought without much thinking. The poem struck a chord with contemporary readers who appreciated its detailed prescription for happiness. Those who disagreed with some of its finer points knew the text could be modified to suit. For example, Tom Killigrew, the pseudonymous editor of the Merry Quack Doctor, a collection of jests, jokes, puns, quibbles, and waggeries, reprinted another version of True Happiness. The textual differences between the Gentleman's Magazine version and Tom Killigrew's text suggest somewhat different ideas of happiness. The pleasant joke of the original, a symbol of fun in moderation, gives way to buckish, lascivious, jokes in Killigrew's racier version. As an adolescent and later as an adult, Washington found the even-handed happiness espoused by the anonymous contributor to the Gentleman's Magazine more amenable than Killigrew's ribald version. The appeal of True Happiness for George Washington also reflects his father's influence. Augustine Washington, who died around the time George most likely encountered this poem, personally exemplified the ideal life it articulates. If Augustine's son George looked forward to a quiet life without much thinking, however, he was destined for disappointment. The most renowned document that survives among the school exercises is George Washington's Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior in Company and Conversation, a set of 110 rules designed to guide social conduct. Like the two poems, Rules is not Washington's composition. These rules stem back to a mid-17th century conduct book, Francis Hawkins's Youth's Behavior, or Decency in Conversation Amongst Men, which itself stems back to a 16th century French work. Though often discussed, Washington's rules have inspired little curiosity regarding their precise origins. After youth's behavior appeared, Hawkins's rules were copied and recopied numerous times. William Winstanley recopied them for inclusion in New Help to Discourse, a steady-selling folk book that constituted an agricultural handbook, conduct manual, and jest book all rolled into one. Including Hawkins's rules, Winstanley instructed readers how to behave in social situations. The rest of New Help to Discourse offered numerous topics of conversation. Altogether, the contents of Winstanley's book told readers what to say and how to say it. It was one of many books published in the late 17th and early 18th century designed as conversational aids. First published in 1669, New Help to Discourse went through several reprintings in the coming decades. The work contains extracts from many different sources. As Winstanley admitted in a prefatory poem, he undertook to draw from others' works the following book. Numerous English editions of New Help to Discourse reached the American colonies in the late 17th and early 18th century. In 1722, Benjamin Franklin's brother James reprinted the book in Boston. Washington's Rules of Civility may stem from Hawkins, but its text comes much closer to Winstanley's. Compare the initial rule in each, first Hawkins, then Winstanley, then Washington. Every action done in the view of the world ought to be accompanied with some sign of reverence, which one beareth to all who are present. Every action done in the world ought to be done with some sign of respect to those that are present. Every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present. Either Washington derived rules from Winstanley's New Help to Discourse, or he got them from an intermediate source. Perhaps his domestic tutor had a set of rules in manuscript to share with his students. Such rules of conduct were frequently transmitted from print to manuscript and then from one manuscript to another. Through this process of copying and recopying, numerous changes, some deliberate, others inadvertent, would enter a text. Many of Washington's rules concerned speaking in company. Rule 47, for instance, affirms his preference for pleasant jokes over buckish ones. Mock not nor jest at anything of importance. Break no jests that are sharp biting, and if you deliver anything witty and pleasant, abstain from laughing thereat yourself. Rule 58 says, let your conversation be without malice or envy. According to Rule 62, people should make their words suit the general tenor of a conversation. Speak not of doleful things in a time of mirth or at the table. Rule 72. Speak not in an unknown tongue in company, but in your own language, and that as those of quality do, and not as the vulgar. Rule 89. Speak not evil of the absent, for it is unjust. Other rules concern what to wear, how to stand, how to sit, when to gesture, when not to gesture, how and when to tip your hat, how to behave toward friends, how to behave toward strangers, how to act at the dinner table, and how to blow your nose, cough, sigh, sneeze, spit, and yawn. Following both Hawkins and Winstanley, Washington also included a rule about reading in the company of others. Rule 18. Read no letters, books, or papers in company, but when there is a necessity for the doing of it, you must ask leave. Come not near the books or writings of another so as to read them unless desired, or give your opinion of them unasked. Also, look not nigh when another is writing a letter. Reading aloud in company was a popular diversion in Washington's day. It not only provided a form of entertainment, It also served as a way to introduce controversial new ideas to a gathering of people. Though Washington was not against reading for either entertainment or edification, he apparently believed that a group of people should agree on what to read. As Rule 80 has it, "Be not tedious in discourse or in reading unless you find the company pleased therewith." For the most part, though, reading was a solo activity. According to Rule 18, it should stay that way. Reading to yourself in the presence of others is rude. Only read in company when absolutely necessary, and even then ask the others for permission. Reading over someone's shoulder is in poor taste, too. Don't do it. By all accounts, Washington studied these rules closely and sought to obey them all his life. They helped make him the model of a proper gentleman. The school exercises say little about Washington's linguistic studies. According to Rules of Civility, correct social behavior does not require a knowledge of foreign languages. Washington himself admitted that he could not read French, but it wasn't for want of trying. Years later, he would add to his library at Mount Vernon a copy of Louis Chambeau's French-English Dictionary, a methodical work that corrected numerous errors of previous dictionaries. Washington's library also suggests a general curiosity about Latin. He owned the Latin New Testament, edited by Theodore de Beze, Calvin's friend and successor at Geneva, and Joseph Davidson's Latin-English edition of Ovid's Metamorphoses. In a contemporary biographical sketch, John Bell of Maryland said Washington had received a slight tincture of the Latin language. No other evidence suggests that he studied either Latin or Greek. Later, Washington expressed regret about his spotty linguistic knowledge. Toward the end of his life, he urged his adopted grandson and namesake, George Washington Parke Custis, to make an effort to retain his knowledge of Latin grammar and composition all his life. Though Washington never studied Latin formally, he did know a few Latin phrases, including the one that forms the motto for his coat of arms, "Exitus acta probat." Though usually translated, "The event justifies the deeds," the motto could be rendered into English differently. 18th-century lexicographer Robert Ainsworth translated it more simply, "All is well that endeth well." Colonel William Ball, Washington's grandfather, also used a Latin motto on his coat of arms, "Coelumque tueri." These words are shorthand for a lengthier passage from Ovid's Metamorphoses, describing how God created man, which Joseph Davidson translated as follows: "He gave to man a lofty countenance, commanded him to lift his face to heaven, and behold with erected eyes the stars." It's easy to imagine George Washington dipping into his copy of Ovid to locate the source of his grandfather's motto, a passage inspiring us to look toward the sky and gaze into the heavens. Even if Washington could read little Latin beyond these key phrases, he could have read the English text of Ovid's Metamorphoses, which offered much pleasure reading. Ovid synthesized the ancient mythic tradition and reshaped it into an exciting and readable form. Davidson's English version retains the spirit of the original. A modern translator of Ovid's has compared some episodes from Metamorphosis to hard-boiled crime fiction, observing that Ovid has a sadistic streak in him. The fighting of Perseus, the battles of the centaurs, the rape of Philomela are as violent and ugly, while they go on, as anything in Mickey Spillane. Other evidence verifies that Washington closed the gaps in his education by reading English translations of the ancient classics. He read Roger Lestrange's English version of Aesop's Fables. The work stuck with him. Washington's writings contain more than one reference to Aesop. On a nightly basis during the Revolutionary War, he had to devise paroles, passwords for the inspectors of the guard, and corresponding countersigns. He typically used place names, but sometimes he used names of authors for either parole or countersign. One night the parole was Ethiopia, and the countersign was Aesop. This verbal combination suggests Washington's familiarity with the legendary life of Aesop, who supposedly came from Ethiopia. Washington also remembered specific fables, including the one about the fox and the grapes, which he recalled years later. Once upon a time, as Aesop tells the story, a fox stood beneath a grapevine with a succulent bunch of grapes suspended just out of reach. The fox leaped upwards hundreds of times, but to no avail. Gradually tiring, the fox realized it was impossible to get those grapes. "Hang 'em," said the fox, making light of his disappointment. "They're as sour as crabs." After each fable, Lestrange provided additional analysis, explaining in this instance, "'Tis matter of skill and address, when a man cannot honestly compass what he would be at, to appear easy and indifferent upon all repulses and disappointments." Washington took the advice to heart. Though he lacked a reading knowledge of other languages, Washington reinforced his mastery of English with the Royal English Grammar, a steady seller compiled by James Greenwood, Sir Master of St. Paul's School in London, who provided 18th-century students with an excellent guide to the subject. As one poetical schoolmaster remarked, "And if true English you would write, by grammar rules you must indite, and if those rules you fain would know, on Greenwood's grammar pains bestow." Washington owned the third edition of Greenwood, which was published in 1747, the year he turned 15. His surviving copy reveals its use. The corners of the pages are heavily worn from frequent bethumbings. Washington's teenaged study of Greenwood shows the limits of his linguistic knowledge. 15 was fairly late for studying English grammar. Better educated Virginia students mastered Latin and had Greek well in hand by that age. Greenwood designed his work specifically for students who had never learned Latin. Greenwood's grammar goes well with Washington's rules of civility. Whereas the rules stressed the importance of speaking properly, Greenwood extended that idea to the realm of the written word to emphasize the social value of writing properly. In essence, Greenwood made English composition a matter of proper social conduct. Extracts from his preface could easily be slotted into Washington's Rules of Civility. Consider the following comment. "For though it is possible that a young gentleman or lady may be enabled to speak well upon some subjects, and entertain a visitor with discourse agreeable enough, yet I do not well see how they should write anything with a tolerable correctness unless they have some taste of grammar, or express themselves clearly, or deliver their thoughts by letter or otherwise, so as not to lay themselves open to the censure of their friends for their blamable spelling or false syntax." Washington learned his lesson well. His teenage correspondence bears out Greenwood's point. In an undated letter written in his late teens, Washington calls the personal letter the greatest mark of friendship and esteem you can show to an absent friend. The chapter on syntax may be the most important one in Greenwood's book. It calls syntax the end of grammar and demonstrates the importance of joining words together properly, that is, making them both stylistically and rhetorically effective. Like Greenwood's other chapters, it is structured as a series of questions and answers. Greenwood not only taught syntactical rules, he also supplied the exceptions to them. Answering a question about whether an adjective should always come before the noun it modifies, Greenwood said yes, but then explained that in some cases it could come afterwards. In poetry, adjectives were frequently placed after nouns for the more harmonious sounding of the verse. Greenwood illustrated the exception with a memorable phrase from Milton, "Human face divine." Greenwood's advice and examples helped Washington hone his writing skills. The final section of the book, A Praxis on the Grammar, provides a series of sample texts and discusses each word in every sample, noting all the parts of speech. The section is divided into three subsections. The second discusses the Lord's Prayer, the third the Apostles' Creed. But the initial subsection begins with a series of simple sentences. The very first one is a delight. Good boys love good books. The attention Washington paid to Greenwood's grammar when he was in his teens indicates a strong desire for self-improvement on his part, an impulse he shared with many other young men in colonial America. He was not the only one to get his grammar from Greenwood. Benjamin Franklin expressed his debt to Greenwood's grammar, which he remembered reading in his teens, "While I was intent on improving my language." Actually, Franklin misremembered. The work he read in his teens was Charles Gildon's grammar, not Greenwood's. But the reason Franklin gave for reading grammar also applies to Washington, who obviously studied Greenwood to improve his writing skills. One work both Franklin and Washington read as part of their education was John Sellar's Practical Navigation, another textbook that could be found throughout colonial America. In his autobiography, Franklin says he read Sellar's Practical Navigation for the geometry it contained, but admits he never progressed very far in his study of the subject. Sellar's handbook contains much else besides geometry. In essence, it taught contemporary students all the mathematics necessary for the practice of navigation. Sellar's editor, John Colson, compared the book to a lighthouse that mariners used to guide themselves safely over the seas. Sellar himself recognized the significance of his subject. In the opening paragraph to Practical Navigation, he defined it in grandiose, albeit endearing terms, calling navigation the beauty and bulwark of England, the wall and wealth of Britain, and the bridge that joins it to the universe. George Washington studied practical navigation for its mathematics, but he learned some basic geography as well, copying Sellar's geographical definitions verbatim into his school exercises. Following Sellar, Washington defined a continent as a great quantity of land, not divided nor separated by the sea, wherein are many kingdoms and principalities, as Europe, Asia, and Africa are one continent, and America is another. Washington's division of continents differs from modern taxonomies, but, as geographers now understand, the continental divisions of the world reflect cultural, intellectual, and social developments more than geographical fact. Practical Navigation was not the only textbook on the subject Washington read. His copy of Archibald Patoon's Complete Treatise of Practical Navigation at Mount Vernon contains annotations in his hand showing that Washington read the book so closely he recognized a mistake in one of Patoon's examples. Patoon described in detail how to determine the sun's declination at St. Lucia on April 6th with reference to the tables for the declination of the sun. Carefully studying the example, Washington checked the tables himself and noticed an error. In the margin adjacent to the example, Washington noted that Patoon had mistakenly calculated the declination for May 6th, not April 6th. Washington also started reading history in his youth, as his copy of Thomas Prince's Chronological History of New England in the Form of Annals indicates. The authenticity of Washington's autograph on the title page of this surviving volume has come under question. The uncertainty is understandable. Few Boston imprints made it to colonial Virginia. Before the first printing press was established in Williamsburg in 1730, most books sold and read in Virginia came from London. Even after the establishment of the local printing industry, Virginians still imported much of their reading material from London. But this copy of Prince's Chronological History somehow found its way to colonial Virginia. Another Washington autograph, which appears part way through the volume, and which has so far gone unnoticed, verifies his ownership. Gauging by the initial title page autograph, Washington acquired this volume when he was in his late adolescence or early teens. Prince's Chronological History provides a good touchstone for understanding how the New England Puritans saw themselves in relation to the history of the world. Prince did not start his chronology in 1620, when the Pilgrims landed, or in 1614, when Captain John Smith coined the name New England, or in 1492, when Columbus reached the New World. He started with creation. In other words, the Puritans saw the founding of New England as part of God's grand design, which extended as far back as creation. The first section of Prince's Chronological History goes to 1603, after which its author begins a new section with a second title page, The New England Chronology. Washington signed this title page too, but according to the style of his handwriting, he did so when he was in his late teens. Like his copy of Offspring Blackall's Sufficiency of a Standing Revelation, Washington's copy of Prince's Chronological History suggests that he acquired the book in his boyhood, had difficulties with it and set it aside, but returned to it when he was older and read it all. The school exercises suggest other books Washington read in his youth. On the bottom half of the leaf containing True Happiness, for instance, he copied a recipe, to keep ink from freezing or molding, which involved putting a few drops of brandy into the ink. He did not name his source, but similar recipes occur in contemporary self-help books, including William Mather's Young Man's Companion or Arithmetic Made Easy, and George Fisher's The Instructor or Young Man's Best Companion. Washington's text varies slightly from the versions in both works. During the Civil War, Union troops in Virginia turned up a copy of Mather's Young Man's Companion with a dated autograph on its title page, George Washington, 1742. Calling it one of the most interesting books in the world, a 19th-century newspaper reporter overstated its importance, but nevertheless reflected the ongoing curiosity about the books Washington read as a boy. Washington's editors have since questioned the authenticity of the dated signature. The possibility that Washington borrowed his recipe for freeze-proof ink from Mather's Young Man's Companion suggests that the signature could be genuine and justifies another glance at this practical manual. Though subtitled Arithmetic Made Easy, Mather's textbook contains more than mathematics. It presents an eclectic mix of useful information, explaining how to write English, create basic legal forms, understand world geography, maintain a garden, manage fruit trees, and prepare useful medicines. In short, this Young Man's Companion was a vade mecum designed to help readers educate themselves in all the fundamental skills necessary to lead a useful, healthful, bountiful life. It offered a book-length prescription for true happiness. So did The Instructor, or as it was better known, Fisher's Companion. As Fisher explains in the preface, his work could serve as the first step of forming the young man's mind for business. It helped 18th-century readers learn the basics of business without the help of a master. It taught accounting, arithmetic, bookkeeping, practical geometry, and business writing. Furthermore, Fisher's Companion provided much additional miscellaneous information, household hints concerning how to candy apricots, pickle cucumbers, preserve currants, and make cider, gardening tips, basic medical information, and an introduction to farriery, explaining how to choose, groom, diagnose, and treat horses. Its contents may seem quite basic, but the diversity and practicality of its information made the work useful for more educated readers, too. David Black, a contemporaneous Virginia physician, had a copy of Fisher's Companion in his library in Prince George County. So did colonial North Carolina physician John Eustace. All this talk about books may give the impression that Washington was a bookish lad who spent most days reading, so a slight correction is necessary. A traditional story from his youth that circulated in the family provides a more balanced portrait, depicting him as both a reader and an athlete. One day, many local teenage boys participated in a series of wrestling matches. As they competed, Washington sat beneath a nearby tree reading a book. After easily defeating all the others, the strongest boy called for a final competitor, someone who could give him a greater challenge. He taunted Washington, calling him a coward for refusing to wrestle. Washington calmly closed his book, walked into the ring, and in a fierce but momentary struggle, wrestled the boy to the ground and emerged victorious. The story sounds fanciful, but a surviving description of Washington's physical stature in his youth provides some corroboration. Buckner Stith, a childhood friend, described Washington as a sound-looking, modest, large-boned young man. Having heard the wrestling story told and retold, G.W.P. Custis felt free to embellish it further. His version includes a comment the loser supposedly made after the match. In Washington's lion-like grasp, I became powerless and was hurled to the ground with a force that seemed to jar the very marrow in my bones. The other boys cheered for Washington, who, instead of celebrating his victory, returned to the shady spot beneath the tree, picked up his book, and continued reading. As he matured, Washington's reading became less desultory and more purposeful. Perhaps no single work holds a greater place in his school exercises than William Laybourne's Complete Surveyor. When it first appeared in the mid-17th century, Laybourne's textbook marked an advance in the history of books as well as the history of surveying. Laybourne's work represents the successful introduction of the geometrical approach to surveying, a subject he treats with vigor and confidence. In addition, Laybourne presented his text and illustrations using a modern page layout that makes his information easily accessible. The Complete Surveyor remained the standard work in the field well into the 18th century. Laybourne helped many early American surveyors get their start. Westmoreland County surveyor Thomas Thompson, for one, owned a copy of Laybourne. But those with better educations and more elite social standing found much to admire in Laybourne, too. The wealthy Virginian Robert King Carter's son Landon had Laybourne in his well-stocked library. Landon Carter had an excellent classical education, and, given his druthers, would have preferred spending his time reading Livy instead of Laybourne. But being one of Virginia's wealthiest landowners, he knew that information gleaned from a surveying textbook could help him secure and maintain his extensive property. 2 decades older than Washington, Carter became a mentor. Their land dealing sometimes brought them together, and both would serve in the Virginia House of Burgesses. When they first met, Carter was quite impressed with Washington and predicted a great future for him. But he also saw room for improvement. Writing to him in 1755, when Washington was 23, Carter advised, "Always in your leisure hours regard the inward man." As his letters to Washington show, Carter did not find their educational differences a barrier to communication. Carter's correspondence with Washington is sprinkled with many charming classical allusions. Washington greatly appreciated the practical value of Laybourne's Complete Surveyor. Its use in his school exercises reveals his dedication to surveying, which gave him a practical outlet for his mathematical skill, one that not only provided a livelihood, but also put him in close contact with the land, something that was becoming increasingly important to him. Washington's exercise notebook demonstrates his natural talent for surveying. It contains surveying exercises that are so varied and meticulous that, as one editor has observed, they must have been self-assigned problems. Though the school exercises do not extend beyond 1748, another book from Washington's library shows that he was still studying mathematics after he had begun his surveying career. He autographed the title page of Guillaume-François-Antoine L'Hospital's Analytic Treatise of Conic Sections and dated his acquisition March 1750. In this work, L'Hospital treats that branch of geometry concerning figures formed from plane sections of a cone, hyperbolas, parabolas, ellipses, and circles. A notoriously difficult subject, conic sections was beyond the reach of most contemporary students. L'Hospital's textbook helped. John Clark, master of the public grammar school at Hull, found L'Hospital's Conic Sections the best available book on the subject. The date Washington acquired his copy of L'Hospital's work may be most revealing. Though the last dated entry in the school exercises is 1748, Washington's study of conic sections in 1750 shows that his attention to educational texts went beyond what the exercises indicate. By 1750, the year he turned 18, the ambitious Washington had already started to establish his reputation as a surveyor. A knowledge of conic sections was not essential to his professional responsibilities, but he found the subject intriguing. Quite simply, he was fascinated with mathematics and sought to learn as much as he could out of his own curiosity. For George Washington, study was not something that ended with youth. It was something to continue throughout adulthood.